It's a very nice village, but it's a bit scattered. It's a bit scattered. Awfully scattered. The scattered community.
I'm here. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Deepest Lore. I'm actually sipping a cup of tea today. It's Grandma Towler's tea, and quite a nice brew it is as well. And so today we are taking a break from our normal little schedule, and I'm going to be talking about professional wrestling. And specifically, I'm going to be talking about professional wrestling from the 1970s. And even more specifically, I'm going to be talking about some of the booking philosophies behind that product that was put out in and around New York in the 70s by Vince McMahon Sr. That is the Vince McMahon that probably many of you know, his father. And then if there's any interest at all in this, I may move on to consider some other people's booking philosophies. Now, just before I continue, I should make it clear that this is not going to be a stream where I try to sell anybody on the idea of pro wrestling. Frankly, I don't care. If you don't like it, who cares? If you like it, who cares? I am also not going to be in the business of rank nostalgia. You know, do you remember the Honky Tonk Man? Do you remember, King Kong Bundy? Do you remember Haku? Do you remember Test and Albert? I am not. This is not going to be a stream about nostalgia of that sort. There are literally thousands of podcasts and shows out there that will provide you that. What I'm going to be doing is hopefully taking a little deep dive into a strange little world in and around WWF in the 1970s. And hopefully this will be interesting to anybody, even people who aren't into wrestling, to see the thinking behind this product. So let us have a look there. I've got a little slide to share on this. So yes, it's called the Vince McMahon Senior Formula. This is Vince McMahon Senior here. This is Bruno Sammartino. He's a superstar Graham and the Grand Wizard with Vince Jr. there, the Vince McMahon, back when he was in his 20s or early 30s there in the 70s. And let's make a start then. So some of the context in and around what we're talking about today. For the purposes of this, I'm going to assume that you're familiar with at least a little bit of wrestling lingo, like, wrestling is all predetermined to the people who are writing the shows are called bookers. They are booking the show. The good guys are called baby faces. The bad guys are called heels. Maybe I'll explain a few more terms as we go along. So Vince McMahon Sr., he owned and booked the WWF territory from the early 1960s to about 1983. He actually sold the company to his son in 1982, but I think for at least the first 6 months of 1983, he was still more or less running the show up until Hulk Hogan becomes the champion, and then Vince Jr. comes in and makes drastic changes. In fact, that would be a whole stream in and of itself, the innovations and changes that Vince Jr. brought in. And the wrestling that many of you will have seen will have been strongly influenced by the Vince Jr. booking philosophy. And I'll mention that as we go along. But anyway, this was his father, who had a very different vision of what wrestling was. So this area, the WWF territory, back in the 70s, wrestling in the US was split into different regions. You had this one up in the northeast. You had the LA territory. You had the San Francisco territory. You had a mid-Atlantic territory in and around the Carolinas. You had that was Jim Crockett Promotions. There was Georgia Championship Wrestling in Georgia. There was about two or three different ones in Texas. You know, the Funks had one in Texas. Tully Blanchard's father had one in Texas. There was one in and around the Midwest and Oklahoma. Later became Bill Watts' Mid-South, but there was a guy called Nick Gulas who ran that area in the 70s. There was a territory called the AWA that was in and around the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul. So, you know, there was a promotion in Detroit run by the Sheik. And there were a few up in Canada as well. One in Calgary run by Stu Hart, and another one run by the, what was his name? By the Tunneys, by Frank Tunney and his brother Jack Tunney, who some people will remember as the on-air president for the WWF later on. And essentially how this worked, it was like a kind of cartel, almost like a kind of mafia deal, where you had these families, and there were other cities as well. St. Louis was a big wrestling city. Sam Muchnick ran that. And there was another one. Houston was a big wrestling city run by a guy whose name is another big time promoter down there as well. Many different. Fritz von Erich was another Texas, world class was another Texas territory. And effectively, what this was, each of the territories had a non-compete clause. So everybody knew, for example, that Vince Senior ran New York. So you weren't going to get Jim Crockett, for example, rocking up in New York and trying to run the garden. Just wasn't going to happen. And likewise, Vince McMahon Senior wasn't going to try to run down in Atlanta. He wasn't going to try to run the Omni. He wouldn't go try to run Greensboro or anything like that. They all had an understanding that they would keep to their respective areas. Okay, so wrestling was very regional, and the idea of competition going head to head didn't really come about until Vince Jr. broke all the rules in the mid 80s there. So Vince Senior, the WWF, had a kind of touch and go relationship with the National Wrestling Alliance, the NWA, Vince Senior had his own world champion, really, Bruno Sammartino. But they, you know, depending on the time, they would also sometimes book the NWA champion, you know, the actual world champion. There's a famous match where Harley Race comes to town when he's the world champ. But for all intents and purposes, it was kind of not really a part of the NWA in the same way that all of the other territories were. It was kind of always on its own. So it was a huge area. You'd basically call it a super territory because it comprised New York, Philadelphia, New Jersey. They ran the Boston Garden, Pittsburgh. It went all the way up to Maine. And later on, they ran in Toronto as well. And, so that's a very big swathe of the country that was came under Vince Senior's remit. And it was the biggest, of the wrestling companies in the country, even during these territorial days. Okay. So, one thing that we may consider if we go on to see what Vince Jr. did was... is to consider, well, he started in a position of relative advantage, you know, one of the biggest media markets in the country, huge population catchment area, several big wrestling towns to draw on. And this is something we'll get on to, but there was a heavy ethnic component to all of these cities. So the champion, as we'll see, was a chap called Bruno Sammartino. He was an Italian wrestler. He came, he fled fled Mussolini and the Nazis during the Second World War, and was kind of, you know, he started working on the docks, a real kind of salt of the earth hero. But of course, you know, Bruno had a massive Italian following, and there were huge numbers of Italians in Philadelphia, in Boston, and in New York. And then, you know, there was Pedro Morales. He was a Puerto Rican. Well, New York had a huge Puerto Rican population. Ivan Putski was a Pole. Well, all the Poles came to cheer Ivan Putski. And this was, you know, and there was certain black wrestlers who'd come in at various different times as well, and that would get the black fans going. So Vince Sr. always had a pretty heavy kind of ethnic component to his card, and it played into the demographics of this region, as we'll see. Now, I should say that even though Bruno was a kind of ethnic champion, he was loved by everybody. It wasn't just Italians who loved Bruno. He was universally loved. He was kind of just like everybody's favorite guy. He had a special connection with the crowd in New York, with the crowd in Philly, with Boston, with Pittsburgh, where he was from originally. You know, that he had the kind of support that people would kind of go to the wall for him. And I'll talk more about that in a moment, because it's kind of a special deal. A lot of the territory is built around the popularity of the champion Bruno. So anyway, Vince Sr. had a number of local lieutenants, including a chap called Phil Zacco, who I'll tell you more about in a second, Willie Gilsenberg, who ran New Jersey, Gorilla Monsoon, who many people will know as an on-air commentator later on, lesser-known guy called Abe Ford ran Boston, and Arnold Scarland was also part of the back office crew. And this is what I mean. I mean, I reckon you could search far and wide and you won't find anybody who'd go into this kind of level of detail for you. You know, if they're going to talk about this era at all, they're just going to, they'll have a few superficial comments to make. They won't give you this stuff. So Vince Sr. ran basically three big shows a month. Madison Square Garden once a month, Philadelphia Spectrum once a month, Boston Gardens once a month. Later on, they also ran the Meadowlands Arena. You know, that was kind of a fourth big show. And then even later on again, they ran an arena called the Capitol Center in Landover, Maryland. So the Cap Center was also a fourth big show. And then later on again, when they acquired the kind of tunny Toronto area, they ran the Maple Leaf Gardens once a month as well. That's more kind of into the early Vince Jr. time, but you'll see a lot of Canadian shows, especially like in Hogan's first year as champ. Those are the big three shows, though. The big show is MSG, Madison Square Garden. The second show is the Philly Spectrum. And I'll just say a few words about the Philly Spectrum. The fans in Philadelphia, the wrestling fans in Philly, were kind of they were legendary in terms of, you know, there are some real kind of working types down there in the 70s, kind of salty atmosphere. They often would, you know, there'd be a contingent who cheer the heels, which was practically unheard of back then. And they were kind of a rabid crowd. So the Spectrum, even though MSG is the wrestling mecca, the Spectrum was kind of a special arena as well. And later, you know, some wrestling fans from a later era would probably remember the ECW ran by Paul Heyman. Well, I mean, it was in and around Philadelphia, and that hardcore contingent of fans around there that formed the backbone of what would become the base of support for ECW later. Okay, so yeah, there was always something about Philly that had that kind of hardcore dynamic with the crowd. And then the Boston Gardens was another kind of big venue that they'd run. Vince Sr. also ran two TV shows every week, Championship Wrestling. This came from this kind of decrepit old agricultural hall in Allentown. If you've ever seen one of those, they've got a very particular atmosphere. You know, it's very dingy. The announcer is a guy called Joe McHugh. Joe McHugh. He was the announcer. And that was the A show, Championship Wrestling. And then there was also All-Star Wrestling, which was the B show. That also came out of Pennsylvania. It was in an arena called the Field House. And they're a really dingy, kind of dingy setting. And the announcer on that show was Gary Michael Capetta. Gary Michael Capetta. You probably remember him from WCW. Some fans may remember him. He went on to work for Crockett and later on for WCW. And those shows, you think of wrestling shows today, you'd think of Raw or SmackDown or, if you're a bit older, maybe WCW Nitro. But, I mean, though these shows, these Championship Wrestling and All-Star are a far cry. They were very kind of, it's an hour. It's every single match is a jobber match. There was never any star versus star action on TV. It was just kind of a showcase, really, for who was on the roster at the time. You know, it'd be like, it's Stan Stasiak coming back in, and he's going to face Frankie Williams. the jobbers were really jobbery. A jobber is a guy who just loses, a wimp, basically, who just gets beaten up on TV. Essentially, it was just a little advert. The TV at this time wasn't really it was a product. People did watch it, but the main point of the television was to get people into the arenas to pay tickets to come and see, go to MSG, go to the Philly Spectrum, go to your local show to see the stars in action. So it was just a kind of like a preview, like a showcase. At this time, that was what the TV was meant to be. So they didn't need any more than just kind of stars versus jobbers. And then there'd be a kind of set of interviews. Vince Jr., who was the commentator, the Vince that you know, what it was back then. He was a kind of a smooth talking commentator. He would give a few interviews and things, and you'd rarely see like Bruno Sammartino on those TV shows. In fact, for a lot of the time he sat on commentary. Bruno did, so he was on TV, but you'd seldom see him in the ring. You had to pay to go and see Bruno because he was such a big star. And then there were a number of smaller shows, in the territory that they'd run all the time. Much smaller venues, the gyms, whatever it happened to be. I know one of the kind of legendary small venues they played was a place called the Zembo Mosque. But you didn't typically see, they weren't filmed. They were just kind of house shows that people could go to, local show. Bruno, he would routinely sell out all of these venues every month. For a long time, he held the record of record attendance at Madison Square Garden, and he really was a very popular star. One other kind of small detail before we get into the ins and outs here is that Vince Sr. also managed the bookings for Andre the Giant. So obviously, Andre the Giant, probably one of the most famous wrestlers of all. Even if you're not into wrestling, you would have seen him in The Princess Bride, probably, or you just know who Andre the Giant is, right? And he was a major attraction. But he had to be used relatively sparingly. Like, you couldn't have Andre on the card week in, week out, because the crowd would burn out, right? It's it's a big deal to see a guy who's almost 8 foot tall, the 8th wonder of the world. And especially in his younger days, like Andre, if you've seen Andre at WrestleMania 3, he was kind of old and broken down. But when he was a bit younger, he could move. In fact, Andre has some tremendous matches to his name, especially when he went over and worked in Japan. There's one Andre the Giant versus Stan Hansen match I can remember seeing where they beat the living shit out of each other, to be honest. And it's a great, it's a great match. And you think, wow, this is not the Andre that you saw it, at WrestleMania 5 beating up Bobby Heenan. This is a much different beast. But anyway, you couldn't really book him week in, week out. So what Vince Sr. would do, he'd loan Andre out to all of the other promoters around the country. So Andre had a wild schedule. Like, he'd work Detroit and then he'd go up to Toronto and then he'd turn up in St. Louis and then he'd go and work in Houston. And it was always a major deal when Andre came to town. So he was like a kind of traveling attraction. And Vince Sr. got a piece of, like, Andre would usually come in and take a percentage of the gate, and Vince Sr. took a cut of what Andre would make. So that was kind of a regular nice little earner for Vince Sr. Just making sure that people can see what I'm saying here. Just want to make sure my new mic is working. Last bit of context. Now, within the kind of strange world of wrestling fandom, there were always two types of fans. There were the kind of what they call the marks, the fans who'd go along and they'd cheer the heroes and they'd boo the heels and they'd just kind of watch it and they'd believe in what they were seeing. Like, they may have some idea that it was predetermined, but for all intents and purposes, they bought into the reality of it. Much like how when you watch a film, you buy into the reality of the film, even though you know they're actors, even though you just buy into it to become part of the drama. And that is experiencing wrestling as a quote-unquote mark. But there were also these so-called smart fans, and they were smart because they were aware of, the true nature of it, that it was all predetermined. It's not really scripted, but the wrestlers aren't really fighting each other, they're cooperating, right? And once you start seeing wrestling through that lens, which unfortunately has become like the default lens, in this age of the internet, almost all of the fans are quote unquote smart, so everybody watches wrestling in this way now. We'll get into whether these people are as smart as they think they are in a second. So one of the criteria by which smart fans like to judge wrestlers was something called work rate. Okay. A worker is another name for a wrestler, because it's a work, right? It's a trick. They're working the fans, who are marks. So this is all kind of old carny speak. It comes from the heritage of wrestling as a wrestling start as a sideshow attraction with the traveling carnival. They go to town to town and, they may have a wrestling match, and originally they'd have, professional wrestlers working people from the crowd. Some mark from the crowd would say, "Oh, okay, I'll take you on." And, it would be like that. And then obviously over time, even the guy from the crowd was not a real punter. He was a worker. And so that's how it kind of got going back in the distant past. But anyway, so in the parlance, that is what a worker is. And the smart fans, they like something called work rate. Okay. Which is basically doing a lot of stuff. Right. And probably the ultimate work rate wrestler, also in my opinion, the greatest wrestler as well. But he, a guy with a very high work rate was Ric Flair. Okay. If you ever watch a Ric Flair match and when he was in his prime, he'd take two gorilla press slams, a suplex, he'd come off the top rope, you know, run over to the next rope, flip over, flare flip, flare flop, you know, inside cradle, you know, then he does his own suplex, you know, takes a big bump onto the floor. You know, this is a very high work rate style. And the smart fans, they always preferred the high work rate guys like Ric Flair. Whereas this territory was known as basically being the opposite of that. It was a very low work rate territory. There was a lot of big men there. Now, if you've ever seen Ric Flair, you know, he's a big guy compared to any of us, you know, because he's a wrestler, but he's not like a big, big guy like a Bruno was or like a Billy Graham would have been. And so, this territory had a lot of kind of slow punch kick type matches, very low work rate, not going to see many suplexes or, you know, flying body presses or moves in that way in this promotion. However, there's a kind of another way of looking at it. So if you talk to any of these old guys who'd work this territory, they'd say, well, who's the really the smart one? In order to get the fan reaction, Ric Flair has probably expended about 1,000 calories jumping up and down and taking 5 suplexes and all the rest of it. Whereas, you know, someone like Chief J Strongbow, I remember watching a match from 1973, Chief J Strongbow versus Mr. Fuji. Some of you will probably remember Mr. Fuji as the manager later on. You know, they must have done about 4 moves in about 20 minutes, you know. 3 punches, you know, 1 bump, no moves at all, couple of chokes. And yet, that Madison Square Garden crowd was absolutely wild. They were eating out of the palm of their hand. They couldn't wait for Mr. Fuji to get his comeuppance against Strongbow, and they were going absolutely wild. So the question is, well, what is really working smart? You could say, well, you know, Mr. Fuji and Jay Strongbow, they figured something out there. Their psychology, their crowd psychology, their command of wrestling basics is so, you know, is so phenomenal. And Vince Sr. has trained this MSG crowd so well that they don't need 100 moves in order to elicit that reaction. So there's a kind of split in philosophy between, you know, what is it that truly makes a great worker? And, you know, I think in the internet culture, it went very far one way where, you know, it's like, well, all right, but now we've seen, you know, guy do a triple backflip off the top rope and 15 suplexes. What now? You know, so there is, you know, it continues to be a problem, actually. There's a particular kind of indie style that still kind of persists. Although there are signs of that. There have been promising signs of people working a bit, you know, quote, having more of an appreciation for some of the other aspects of wrestling, not just moves and high impact maneuvers and so on. That said, you know, some of the stuff from this era is pretty hard going, to be honest. But still, now another slightly unusual aspect of this territory is that there were a lot of what was called homesteaders. So, you know, your typical wrestler of this era, they'd work six months in one promotion, and then they'd had their run, and then they'd move on to the next place. One of my favorite wrestlers was Ted DiBiase. You know, later on, the Million Dollar Man. But if you have a look early in Ted DiBiase's career, you know, in 1979, he comes in and he has a run in, you know, he has a run in New York. He works Madison Square Garden. He has a great feud with Pat Patterson. Couple of tag matches, faces Andre. He actually tags with Andre. He was a babyface at the time. You know, then 5 or 6 months are done, and it's time for DiBiase to move on. Great talent, phenomenal worker, but it's time for him to do something else. So maybe he moves, you know, then he went to work for Barber in All Japan, for example, tagging with Stan Hansen. And then from there, let's say he went to work for Bill Watts in Mid-South, or he'd do a stint with the Funks in Texas. And then from there, he could go down and work in Georgia, et cetera, et cetera. And that's how most wrestlers of that era made their money. They didn't just stay in one company. They traveled around, okay? But there were guys who just stay in one place, and they were known as homesteaders. Now, this is distinct from Bruno. Bruno is what you'd call the ace, the linchpin of this promotion. And there are obvious aces. Often, the ace would also be the owner of the promotion. So an example of that would be, you know, I mentioned Fritz Von Erich down in down in Texas. Like, all of his main stars were his own sons, like the Von Erichs, Kerry Von Erich, and later on became the Texas Tornado, and David Von Erich, and kind of a tragic family in many ways. But, you know, the aces of the linchpin of that promotion was the family that owned it. Here, obviously, it was Bruno. In Continental, you know, around kind of Tennessee area, Jerry Lawler was a legend down there. He was the ace of that promotion, but also, you know, often a kind of co-owner as well. I mentioned Bill Watts. He was kind of the ace of his own promotion. In the AWA, Vern Gagne, you know, originally was the ace of that promotion before he retired. So then you get guys who are aces, but then you get guys who just kind of hang around one area and they stay there. But usually there are only a handful of guys that would stay in one place. And often they would have something to do with the office. A good example of that would be a guy called Johnny Weaver, who was kind of, I think he married one of the Crockett's, like Jim Crockett's daughter or something. So Johnny, you know, he was a tag star, but he was also always in and around that area. So we'd say he homesteaded in Crockett Promotions. And yeah, this territory had an unusual number of homesteaders, guys who just hung around and stayed there forever. Like guys who were just part of the furniture, who were just, you know, month in, month out, week in, week out, they'd be working here. And because of that, there were a lot of guys who were, let's just say, like, well past their prime, and also well past the point where, I'll explain more in a second, but usually the reasons that wrestlers travel is because if they stayed in one place for too long, they'd get kind of stale, right? They'd get kind of, you know, they'd lose their heat. They'd run out of stuff to do. So it was usually a good idea to maintain that momentum to go to a new place. You'd come in, you'd have to be reintroduced to a crowd, get over, and everybody get excited again for you, right? But if you don't go away, how can anybody miss you? But this roster had a lot of guys who were just there for forever, okay? And I'll get on to who some of those characters were in a second. Now, despite all of this, despite the fact that it was slow and lumbering, that it had low work rate, and that it had a kind of stodgy, old roster of guys who were kind of washed up, apart from Bruno, once you look past the main event, who else is on the card, right? Not a lot going on in many of these cards, as we'll see. Despite all of that, this was still the biggest territory in the USA, and it was seen by everybody in the business as a special payday for anyone who happened to make it to MSG, okay? So even though you'd see, you'd see a certain amount of, snobbishness from NWA types, like, the, you know, Sam Muchnick, or some of the more wrestling purists, you know, the guys who were fans of Luthers back in the day and things like this. Guys who, I mean, an idea of a kind of wrestling purist champion, you know, who would tick all of the boxes for a fan like that, was Dory Funk Jr., who was the who was the NWA champion in the early 70s, very dry, very technical, not a lot of charisma. But the idea was getting over wrestling as a legit sport. They wanted to present it almost like it's kind of athletics or something, like it's just a, like you're going to the Olympics. That was the philosophy of Sam Muchnick and some of those NWA guys. And it's embodied in somebody like Dory Funk Jr. Or, I mean, there were a few other guys like that as well. I mean, Jack Briscoe, to some extent, was part of that ideal of what the NWA wanted. Whereas the WWF world was always a bit kind of a larger than life, a bit more cartoonish, I guess. I mean, Bruno was legit. Bruno was not very cartoonish, but some of the other characters who were around, there was a lot of comedy and, you know, great talkers, guys who were really good on the mic. But in the ring, this wasn't a product. Like, the draw of the product was not really the number of suplexes you were going to see. And it wasn't really the technical wrestling either. This was a kind of wrestling as spectacle. You know, it's the lights of MSG here. So there was always this split between the kind of prestige venues, like St. Louis was a prestige venue. You know, the wrestling snobs that are kind of Dave Meltzers of this world, the Wrestling Observer types, they would want to, you know, it's like, wow, you haven't made it until you've wrestled Harley Race in St. Louis. That was one way of looking at it. But then the other way of looking at it was like, well, yeah, but you can go and wrest in front of 20,000, you know, rabid hot fans at MSG and get a massive payday. So I always thought that the wrestlers who played down the significance of Madison Square Garden, I always remember there was this St. Louis guy called Larry Matisic who was like, yeah, Bruno sold out MSG. But what happened when he came down to St. Louis? Huh? I mean, it was a bit of cope, to be honest. It was the kind of, it's the difference between, how can I say, like guys who were into, it's the kind of, it's the nerd thing of looking down on like Hollywood movies because you're into your art films type thing. And there's kind of a bit of that in the, you know, when you really get into the wrestling fandom. And that was always there. So the purists, they looked down on this territory, but a lot of the workers, they were like, hell yeah, you know, if Vince Senior wants to call me up, I'll go, I'll drop everything and go there. That's one of the things I respect about Ric Flair, actually, is that even though he was always on the other side, he was an NWA guy, he was a Crockett guy, he always admitted that, you know, New York was always the place to be as well. So anyway, I hope you understand that dynamic before we move forward kind of within the fandom. Now, where are we going with this? So, oh yes, the crew of kind of aging homesteaders. They're a unique bunch of individuals. There's Baron Michael Cicluna. Baron Cicluna there. He was a, you know, fairly major star in the mid 60s. But to give you an idea, he's still knocking around on MSG cards in like 1982. You know, he's just never left. You know, and his star had faded a long time ago. Like he was a big star for 1965, but he's like still, you know, still there 20 years later type thing. Another one was with Dominic DeNucci. DeNucci was also a big star in the 60s. He had, I think he had a run as the Australian kind of world champ. There was a promotion in Australia called WCW, a different WCW, not the one that you know. And it was run by, that guy from Georgia. I forget his name now. It was a legendary promoter. A gay guy from Georgia who's his name I forget. Maybe someone in the chat will remind me. But anyway, Dominic DeNucci was a kind of big star in the mid 60s, and he had a run down there. But I think he comes in to, you know, he comes in due to the Italian connection with Bruno. Bruno always had a lot of Italians around him. You know, maybe Bruno needs a tag partner. Well, okay. His friend to the end, Dominic Danucci. Danucci was kind of like the Brutus Beefcake to Bruno's Hulk Hogan, if that makes any sense to you, you know. And as I'm sure some people know, he went on to be a trainer, and he trained Mick Foley famously. Danucci was a kind of mentor to Foley. But anyway, he also hung around forever, forever. I think he was still knocking around on cars in 1982 as well. And in fact, these two, Danucci versus Cluna, you'd have to check the kind of wrestling database, but I think they've got something like over 500 matches against each other, you know, week in, week out, night after night, you know, Danucci versus Baron Cicluna, you know, 20 minute time limit draw, whatever it happens to be. So, you know, I always had the image of them like clocking in and clocking out, you know, and it's, I'll tell you more about these guys in a second. Another one was Tony Garea. He stuck around even into the Vince Jr. Era. These guys at least retired, but he was still there, like in 1985, you know, working the opening match at MSG. Jay Strongbow, another guy. He was Italian as well, by the way. He wasn't really a Native American. That was another common gimmick at the time. He also hung around forever. Ivan Putski. There were all these Johnny Rods and SD Jones were the two kind of black jobber to the stars. You know, Johnny Rods, good guy, like good carpenter, what they call like a good hand. But they never left. They, you know, they could have been stars elsewhere. They could have had, but they wanted to take the guaranteed payday and they just stayed there forever. It was kind of a funny story that a lot of these guys like Danucci, Cicluna, SD Jones, they all became paper delivery salesmen, believe it or not. They, you know, they do go and do the paper round. And the reason that they did that is because in those days, I think if you did a paper round, you got you were part of a union and it gave you a guaranteed pension. So all of these guys, after a certain time, left wrestling and went to do the paper round. So they'd get the guaranteed. So they get the guaranteed pensions, which is always a funny. Imagine having your mail delivered by Baron Cicluna, you know. But yeah, well, there's SD Jones and his name Special Delivery as well. anyway, yeah. So that was the core crew of the kind of the job squad. But as we'll see, these guys make up like 60-70% of every card. It's just various situations of these guys facing each other or against other jobbers. Okay. So this is the Homesteaders. And then, what else have we got here? Right. So, and this is where we're getting, this is called the deeper store for a reason, folks. We're going to go deep. So this is Vince McMahon Sr. And here's his kind of mafioso crew backstage is kind of, this is his, this is behind the scenes team, right? So there's Gorilla Monsoon. That's Pedro Morales, by the way. He was a champion at one point when Bruno wanted to take a break. Arnold Scarland smoking on his big cigar. Phil Zacco. And this guy here is called Willie Gilsenberg. And they were the guys who ran things behind the scenes. And you can only imagine the sort of characters these guys were, you know. Cigar chomping, card playing, hard, kind of slightly seedy promoter world that they were from. These guys were from a world so far away from anything that we know existing now. But it's kind of like, I always think it's fun to think about the sorts of characters these guys were. We'll get on to some of Vince McMahon Sr.'s booking philosophies and strategies, okay? So Vince McMahon Sr., he booked the top three matches on every card. So he was the main booker, but he didn't do everything. He just booked the main three matches. So that's the championship match, the semi-main event, which is often a special feature attraction, which I'll get onto in a second. Or later on, it would have been the Intercontinental Championship match, which was brought in 1979. In fact, that feud I mentioned between Ted DiBiase and Pat Patterson established the... DiBiase came in as the North American champ, and then he had a feud with Pat Patterson. And then after that feud was over, Pat Patterson went away for a week, and he was like, "Where have you been, Pat?" "Oh, I've been in a, I've won a tournament in Rio de Janeiro for the Intercontinental Championship." You know, complete rubbish, of course. There was never any tournament. But anyway, that establishes the IC belt. And last I checked, that Intercontinental Championship is still going. You know, many great IC champs down the years, you know, Greg Valentine, Rick Rude, Mr. Perfect, Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, you know, they all held up a belt at one time or another. And that was always seen as the more kind of technical, that was like the kind of workers' belt, the IC Championship. Less significant in more recent years, I would say, but for a while there, it was a great secondary title. Anyway, he would book those two, the semi-main, the championship match, and also the tag title match. And then he'd leave the rest of them to Gorilla Monsoon, as we'll see. Now, one of the interesting things about Vince Sr. is that, you know, if we come on to look at what his son did, you know, Vince Jr. wanted to make sure that every single person on the roster had a gimmick and was a star. Every single person was a star. Even SD Jones got his own action figure under Vince Jr.'s regime, okay? He wanted every match on the card at WrestleMania to have a storyline going into it. Not just the main event. Every single match would have a story and a feud. You know, and you can go back through the kind of history of the way he's booked it, and it's always been the case that he'd give everybody something to do. Right. Whereas Vince Sr., he'd only run like two or three stories a year. You know, most of the time, the matches that would happen on the cards were happening like for no reason. It was just like filling up. It was just a match, you know, just a match. It would only be like two or three like proper like blood feuds. Now, there are pros and cons to that. The con, I guess, is that there's a lot of kind of filler stuff on Vince Sr. cards. But the pro is that when significant things happen, they really stand out. They really stand out a mile. And when the storylines do happen, they are uber memorable. I'll just mention one example. For years, Larry Zbysko was a kind of protege of Bruno Sammartino. And, you know, he has a little tag run with Tony Garea, and he's just kind of like a little baby face, kind of rookie, just kind of baby mid-carder. And, you know, eventually Larry Zbysko turns on Bruno. This is a famous feud from 1980, and he knocks him over the head with a chair. And it is so good, that feud. I mean, it's just the interviews, the level of, you know, both Larry Zbysko's interviews and Bruno Sammartino's interviews are incredibly heartfelt. Crowd is just electric. So when the stories happen, they're really impactful. When stuff happens, you remember it forever. Whereas, you know, there's so much happening on the typical Vince Jr. show that, you know, you kind of forget many stories and angles because, you know, they're to a penny. You know, they're to a penny. Oh, this guy's turned again for the 15th time. You know, so it's like that's one of the benefits, I would say, of the Vince Sr. philosophy. Downside is that there's a lot more shit on the card, essentially, okay? Another part of Vince Sr. Is that he's... one of his kind of characteristics is that he was very frugal with money. He never spent money if he could get away with not spending it. There were all sorts of stories about his incredible tightness that have emerged over the years. For example, Gary Michael Capetta, who I mentioned, tells a story about how he made $65 a night for his first 4 years, right? His first 4 years, he made $65 a night. And, you know, after eventually he plucked up the courage to go and see Vince Senior. And you can imagine back in those days, approaching a guy like this was almost like approaching a mafia don. It was like, this is the big boss. You've got to be careful when you want to speak to him. And he finally went to go and see Vince Senior and asked for more. And he just did not, like, he just gave him the brush off, didn't respond at all. And then eventually he did get a pay rise, but it wasn't from Vince Senior directly. Like, Gorilla Monsoon took him aside one night and said, here's an extra $10 type thing. So, you know, that's just an example. Like, he was raking it in, but he was very stingy. Despite that, however, despite that stinginess from Vince Senior, the gates were so big at MSG that it was still a pretty good payday for most stars who went to work there. So another kind of example of stinginess, I would say, from him is the fact that, you know, that weekly TV from the Agricultural Hall in Pennsylvania, and the other one down in, where was it? Hamburg, the field house. Like, you can only imagine that he was booking those because they were dirt cheap and he didn't want to spend any extra on, like, set or, you know, same old ring, same old dingy. So, you know, I've often thought, like, when Vince McMahon Jr. says, back in my father's day, pro wrestling was smoky, you know, men in smoky rooms, and I turned it into being this sports entertainment type thing. You know, part of that is bullshit, right? Because, I mean, let's face it, these guys were selling out Madison Square Garden and the Philadelphia Spectrum month after month after month. You know, and they're not small venues. They're major venues sold out by, you know, the likes of Queen, or like major music acts would go and play MSG. But what he's probably got in mind is the look of the TV, right? And Vince Jr., he was always prepared to spend a few quid, you know, spend a few bob on, you know, just little little things like, how does the ring look? Do you have prominent branding everywhere? What are the colors used? Like, all of that sort of stuff is stuff that Vince Jr. took note in, kind of marketing stuff. Vince Senior just had no time for any of that at all, and never changed the look of anything. During all his years. Another strange aspect of the Vince Senior thing. Do you remember I was saying he took a cut of Andre the Giant's pay all around the country? All of the workers who were on contract, you know, those homesteaders, would have to give 25% kickback on their pay to Vince Senior. Now, this has confused me greatly. I don't really understand this, because I've heard guys like Stan Hansen in interviews talk about this, and Bruno Sammartino himself talked about it as well. Like, let's say they were paid a grand, they'd have to give $250 back to Vince Senior. I never understood, like, why didn't he just give them $750? Like, why did he have to have this kickback thing? Maybe it was kind of a loyalty test or something. But there are many stories of how Bill Watts tells a story about how he and Bruno would sometimes, they'd fail to report 5 shows in the month to pocket the difference. So they'd be like, well, you know, we only worked, let's say they worked 20 dates in the month, we only work 15 dates, you know, and they'd sneak the rest. I'm not sure what sort of scam Vince Senior had going there. Another strange aspect of Vince Senior is that he always booked from this tiny room in the Edison Hotel. And Superstar Graham talks about this in one of his interviews, where he says, you know, there were these, like, 6 guys all huddled around this, like, one table in this tiny hotel room, and they would book all of the Madison Square Garden shows from this room. You can imagine, like, and there was so little space in there that they were all, like, kind of shoulder to shoulder, like, huddled up. And again, it kind of, to me, it speaks to the tightness, you know, his tightness. Like, he could easily afford a bigger room, but I don't know, he was just kind of stuck in his ways, I guess. Now Vince Senior had a very conservative vision of what wrestling should be. And his basic philosophy, his basic booking philosophy, was to give the fans as little as possible in order to squeeze more out of them for less. So he wouldn't expect his guys to go out there and work a million miles an hour. He didn't want them to do. In fact, there were stories of Vince Senior, guys going up to New York, and you know, they were used to working for Crockett or you know, Roy Shires or one of these sorts of guys, or Eddie Graham. You know, Florida was another work rate kind of promotion. So they were used to working for promoters like that, who'd expect them to try to go out and give the best match of the night. You know, and they'd go out, you know, they go up to New York wanting to make a big impression, and you know, they give it their all, and they'd come back to the, you know, they'd come back and Vince Senior would give them a bollocking. They'd be like, why are you doing all those moves? What, you're making all the other guys on the card look bad. You're making the main event. You don't want to overshadow the main event. So he actually actively encouraged all of his guys to do less, not more. And this is something that actually persists into the Vince Jr. era. So a lot of work rate guys, when they actually get to New York, even later on in their career, pare down their moveset and actually do less rather than more. You know, I mentioned Ted DiBiase. Ted DiBiase, as the Million Dollar Man, did a lot less. He did a lot less in terms of moves, in terms of work rate and all of that, than he would have done working for Bill Watts. And part of that was driven by the philosophy of the office. In New York, you try to do less, not more. This was part of the style. For some of those Southern promotions especially, it was all about, you know, giving the fans everything. So, you know, again, a disagreement in the vision and what you're trying to do. And you can think what you want. Like, as a fan, you could be like, well, I don't like this product, or, you know, it's boring, or you can think, you know, it's staid, whatever you want. And lots of fans are kind of down on this product. But you have to say that his formula was extremely effective in terms of reliably selling out all his shows. In fact, there's an argument to say, and I haven't done the stats on this, but you could have a look at each of the promoters' gates, by which I mean their, you know, their month in, month out attendance figures, and you could probably say that Vince McMahon Sr. ran the most efficient promotion that wrestling's ever seen. I mean, maybe, and this is something that Bruno Sammartino talks about as well, if you watch some of his interviews. You know, Hulk Hogan, right, he could give you WrestleMania 3 and an attendance of 87,000, okay? But if you're a little kid who's gone to see Hulk Hogan, do you want to go and see him again? Next month? And the month after that? And the month after that? And the month after that? Because what Vince Senior was able to do is that he was able to build up such a loyalty in the fans and such a love for a guy like Bruno that they'd pay and see Bruno month after month after month after month, sell out MSG month after month. And Hulk Hogan was never able to do that. Hulk Hogan was able to sell out somewhere that's had a lot of build up, and it's like people would come from miles around. We have to go and see Hulk Hogan in LA, right? But try to run LA next month and he'd kill the town. Okay. Crowds would burn out very quickly on Hulk Hogan. And I mean, this is something that if I ever get to that era in this little mini series, I mean, I haven't been looking at the chat, so maybe nobody's even watching this. I have no idea. But this is something that we can look at, is that when you have a star like Hogan, the sort of support he builds up is kind of fair weather. It's like going to see a superhero, you know, whereas the support around Bruno is much more like going to see, he was much more like kind of Roy of the Rovers, if you imagine that, or like a local sports hero, like a, there was just a connection there where it's just like, well, that's what we do. It's that time of the month and it's our time to go and see the great Bruno, whether it's in Pittsburgh or Philly or New York or wherever else it happens to be. Okay. People didn't do that for Hogan, to the extent where during like the hottest streak of Hogan. So you'd think, well, you know, 1986, rock and wrestling, Hulk Hogan era, you'd think, well, you couldn't get a hotter streak than that. But actually, even though it looked like he was setting the wrestling world on fire, if you go under the hood, he struggled with a return date at MSG. You know, once you've seen Hulk Hogan versus Kamala, do you want to go and watch it next month? So they actually had a real problem with the traditional traditional loop, and Vince Jr. had to resort to trying to coax Bruno to come out of retirement in 1986. And there's a famous feud that he had with Randy Savage, and Bruno agreed to it because they were trying to get his son over at the time. If you have a look, they bring back Bruno in 1986 to try to help with the gate at MSG and Philly, because Hogan couldn't carry the load, which is not, I mean, it's not, I'm not saying this as a knock on Hogan. He's one of the greatest stars and draws of all time. It's just understanding the sort of commodity he was. He was a bit more like Andre the Giant. Like Andre was like that. You couldn't sell out the same arena with Andre month after month. You'd bring him in once and he'd sell the place out. But then you have to wait like a year to bring Andre back to the same place, because nobody's going to come back. You know, once you've seen him, right? So that's something to bear in mind. And I would argue that Vince Jr. learned that. He got much better with his use of Hogan, and he learned how to use The Undertaker in that way later on. You know, everybody, like The Undertaker, when they were doing that thing called the streak, if you remember, at WrestleMania, they learned, oh, you don't want to see The Undertaker week in, week out, but people will pop to see him once a year, right? And that is what The Undertaker streak was all about. It was kind of trying to bring back the idea of the special attraction, you know, the way that Andre was used, and the way that he learned to use Hogan even during the hot streak. If you remember Hogan, like he wasn't on TV week in, week out by 1987, 88. He'd go away for long periods. He'd go and do movies. He'd be like, and that was actually by design. They'd want to keep him off air because you burn out quick if you see him week in, week out. And that was proven later on when he went to WCW, and he was on Nitro week in, week out. And before the heel turn in 94, 95, you know, the fans burnt out quickly on that. So yeah, something to bear in mind with different types of stars. And in terms of a week in, week out ace for a promotion, you could argue that Bruno Sammartino is arguably the all-time greatest in terms of reliably selling out arenas. I would have to have a look at Austin in the late 90s, because Austin was extremely hot for a period there as well. I think Austin was pretty consistent. The Rock was much more Hogan-y. He was kind of like, well, you could burn out on The Rock. But this is something to think about. Jerry Lawler, actually, as a regional draw in Tennessee, was extremely reliable for many years. Whereas somebody like Ric Flair, as great as a worker as he is, his gate performances are much less consistent, especially if he's in the same place again and again. Flair's role really was as a traveling champion, coming in, everybody get excited to see the champ, but you know, 2 weeks later he's gone again. That was his skill, really. But anyway, let's carry on. So Phil Zacco, this is another member of his crew, and he was a man on the ground in at the Philadelphia Spectrum. And so Vince Sr., he wouldn't be at every venue. I think he used to go to the Spectrum once every 3 months or something. So most of the time, the guy on the ground was Phil Zacco. And he also promoted the Cap Center and Baltimore as well. He was also the payout guy for the whole promotion. And even though Vince Sr. had a reputation for being extremely fair, to give you an idea of the honesty and fairness of Vince Sr., Vince Sr. made a deal and an agreement to make Bob Backlund his champion. He made a deal with Eddie Graham that he was going to take this young kid, Backlund, and turn him into the next champ as the long-term replacement for Bruno Sammartino. But when Bruno dropped the belt to superstar Graham, Billy Graham was extremely hot and had a very, very hot run. Even though he was a heel champ and it was a babyface area, superstar Graham was like electric there. But when the time came for the belt to go to Backlund, he stuck by, you know, other promoters may have been like, oh no, I might ride the superstar Graham thing a bit more. But Vince Sr. was just always by his word. And he was like, right, the time has come. We're going to make Backlund the champion. And then he stuck with him for six whole years with Backlund as the champ. I could say more about Backlund. He was a kind of an interesting worker in his own right. But Zacco was widely perceived as somebody who'd stiff you on the pay. And there are many, many stories of trying to extract your pay from Phil Zacco. Probably he underreported the attendance numbers. You can imagine this guy, he was a bit like the kind of the Penguin out of Batman, you know, cigar chomping, short, fat guy, you know, surly, bad tempered, foul mouthed, you know, just a classic old school promoter, you know. So that was one of Vince Sr.'s number twos there for a long time. And then another major lieutenant was Gorilla Monsoon. Like I said, he was the assistant booker. Vince Sr. booked the top three matches. Monsoon booked the undercard. And Monsoon was responsible for bringing in the undercard talent. So he'd book a lot of... He not only booked the undercard, but he'd actually bring them in from, you know, because they needed guys. And because he owned a 10% stake in Carlos Colon's Puerto Rican promotion, the WWC, when you talk about mob connections, they were, I don't want to speculate, but it's almost certain that those guys had some shady connections in Puerto Rico there. Monsoon used a lot of Puerto Ricans. So you'll see, like, if you have a look at the card, you'll be like, who's this guy Rivera and that guy Estrada? These are guys brought in by Monsoon, the Puerto Rican connection. And that wasn't any bad thing because there was always a contingent of the crowd who were Puerto Rican. So the Puerto Rican stars got over very well with the Puerto Ricans. And there's Pedro Morales there. He was made the champion, I want to say, in 1971. You may want to check the dates. But Vince Sr. always kept a babyface champion. This is something to think about when it comes to booking philosophy. You can either have a babyface champ with a conveyor belt of villains to face, or you can have a heel champion with a chasing babyface. Okay, and WWF was always a babyface promotion, and Bruno got burnt out basically, you know, by the early 70s. He wanted to have a break. The dates were getting too much for him, so he wanted to drop the belt, and that is when Ivan Koloff became the champion. But he was what they call a transitional champion. When a promoter wants to put the belt on another babyface, but he does not want to book a babyface versus babyface match, so he didn't want to have Bruno versus Pedro, he needed somebody to carry the belt in the interim, and Ivan Koloff was that man. He was the transitional champion in 1971, won the belt from Bruno. And the story is that when Ivan Koloff won the belt, the crowd was so quiet that people could have heard a pin drop. And I can believe that because, I mean, in all my years of watching wrestling, I have never seen or heard crowds more electric and more white hot than they are for Bruno. He really was like, you know, it's hard to put into words how just how much the guy was loved. And so the idea of it, and he never lost, right? He basically always came out on top. So the fact that he actually lost to Ivan Koloff was an absolute shock to a lot of people. And then Pedro, when he became the champion, he did all right in Madison Square Garden, but he struggled in some of the secondary market. I think he did all right in Philly as well, but he struggled to sell out Boston Gardens. He struggled to sell out Pittsburgh. And eventually Vince Sr. was like, Bruno, you're going to have to come back here. I know you're tired, but they struggled under Pedro because they couldn't sell out those secondary markets. Whereas Bruno was consistent across the board, no matter where they went. Pedro, he was over with the Puerto Rican fans. He was over with the New York fans, but struggled in other areas. Like the guys in Pittsburgh were like, we want Bruno back, basically. So that's why Bruno came back. And I think Pedro drops the belt to Stan Stasiak. And then Stasiak's like a transitional champion. He has it for a few weeks and then he loses it back to Bruno. And then Superstar Graham was meant to be a transitional champion as well. But he ends up keeping the belt for quite a while, like a year almost, or 9 months or something, before he drops it to Bob Backlund. So that's how they get the belt off Bruno and back onto Backlund, is through Superstar Graham. And the WWF would carry on doing this even in the Vince Jr. years. So rather than have Hogan versus Backlund, if you remember, the Iron Sheik comes in and defeats Backlund, and then a month later Hulk Hogan defeats the Iron Sheik for his first title. So they would always do that. They'd use a transitional champion. They even did it when Randy Savage became the champion in 88. You know, they had the whole tournament around WrestleMania 4, and Ted DiBiase tried to buy the belt, and then there were shenanigans, and Andre won it and sold it, and so rather than have a straightforward match, they kind of came up with that scenario to get the belt off Hogan onto, in that case, it was less about those two facing each other and more about the prospect of Hogan taking a pin, right? They did a kind of screw dog job type finish on that. Then of course Hogan wins it back from Savage a year later. And then they did finally do a babyface versus babyface, Hogan versus Warrior. Was that WrestleMania 7? Someone have to double check. Well, no, WrestleMania 6 was a Hogan versus Warrior. And then their way of getting the belt off Warrior was Sergeant Slaughter, if you remember. So Sergeant Slaughter is yet another transitional champion. Talking about phenomenal talents, by the way, early Sergeant Slaughter is very good around, comes in 81 against Backlund. He's just, again, tremendous wrestler. Anyway, let's carry on. So Gorilla Monsoon, he was also the man on the ground at the TV tapings, and he'd send the reports back to Vince Sr. He was known for standing in this place called the Gorilla Position. There was just they were very basic kind of venues, these Allentown and Hamburg. So there was just a curtain there, and Gorilla Monsoon would stand in that, next to that curtain, and he'd be wearing a pair of glasses, and he'd take those glasses off to let the workers know when to go to their finish. So when they saw that he took the glasses off, they'd know to finish their match. So that was a kind of famous piece of wrestling lore with Monsoon in this era. What happened with Monsoon is that because all of these guys had some minor stake in the territory, when Vince Jr. bought the territory in 1982, all of these guys they got kind of lifetime guarantees of being paid and being on the payroll, and that's why he became an on-air commentator, because Vince Jr. wanted to give him something to do, basically, so they made him a commentator. Gorilla Monsoon had a phenomenal payoff deal with that. Not only did he get a lifetime wage, but he got every single card the WWF ran, right, until he died, this was, Gorilla Monsoon would get the preliminary wrestler's play times 1.5 for every single card. So it would be like he had worked in the opening match on every single house show, every single kind of main event, every MSG, every WrestleMania. Gorilla Monsoon got a payoff. Talk about sweet golden handshake deals for Gorilla Monsoon. So he must have been absolutely minted by the time he died. Anyway, another part of Vince Senior's crew is called this old time boxing promoter Willie Gilsenberg, and he promoted shows in New Jersey as well as Scranton, and he would have also been responsible for any shows that were run at the Meadowlands Arena as well. He actually died in 1978, so he doesn't make it into the Backlund era, really. But he was a mainstay there for many, many years. He probably, I don't know anything about boxing, but guys who are into boxing probably would have known Gilsenberg as a bit of a kind of Don King character back in the 1930s and 40s and things like that. Anyway, because of his many, many years promoting boxing and wrestling shows, Gilsenberg had a lot of connections everywhere. So he was a kind of fixer. If Vince Sr. needed something fixing with a local venue, Gilsenberg would be the guy to get on the blower. You know, you can imagine the kind of sleazy conversation. Hey, Harry, can you do me a favor? We need to. You can just imagine the sort of characters these were. And there were also at this time, because wrestling wanted to maintain this veneer of legitimacy, they had to make deals with the local state athletic commission. And if you ever watch any of these cards, you'll always hear the announcer reference, you know, we're here under the Maryland State Athletic, you know, the authority of the Maryland State Athletic Commission. And this comes into play a few times. Like, some of the state athletic commissions had different rules. And one of those rules was around blood, I seem to recall. So in some venues, blood would cause an automatic stoppage, I believe. And that was to comply with state athletic commission rules, apparently. Gilsenberg also got stories into newspapers if they ever wanted to run, you know, if they ever wanted a local newspaper to say, oh, you know, the wrestlers are coming to town, you know, exclusive interview with Bruno Sammartino, Gilsenberg would be the guy. He also acted as the on-air president for the WWF up until he died. I think he was replaced with a Japanese fella. What was that guy's name? Hold on. On-air WWF president, Japanese. Who was that guy? I forget his name now. So I mean, a lot of you guys will remember Jack Tunney, right? But before Jack Tunney, there was another president, Vince Sr. made a deal with Antonio Inoki to book New Japan talent on his shows, and for them to book some of his guys in Tokyo. So there are matches around this time where Antonio Inoki comes in for a shot against Backlund. Oh God, that's a. I mean, I kind of like Backlund. You know, style gets a while to get used to, but I have always struggled to get into Inoki. You know, chin lock and bloody half an hour headlock, and just God. There are a few hour long draws I've seen Backlund versus Inoki, but I think the deal was is that Inoki would come to New York and work MSG, but then Backlund would return the favor and go over to Tokyo and, work a match over there type thing. So, Yeah, I can't remember the guy. Can't remember the Japanese guy though, who actually became the on-air president. Somebody may have to jolt my memory here because I've forgotten the guy's name. On air WWF Japanese president. Well, I'm trying to give you deep, deep, deep lore here, and my memory has failed me, unfortunately. Wasn't a, I mean, while I'm looking, I was a little bit impressed with Samia Gog, my buddy, because when we started talking about wrestling, he said that he once dated the daughter of Hiro Matsuta, the guy who trained Hulk Hogan and was part of Eddie Graham's crew in Florida, like a kind of number two guy for Eddie Graham. Famously broke Hulk Hogan's leg on the first day of his training. And he was well known as a very hard man, Hiro Matsuta. And Samia Gog went out with his daughter and was saying that, he was on his best behavior there because you do not want to mess with Hiro Matsuda. Anyway, the name of the Japanese on-air president was Hisashi Shinma. He became the on-air president for the WWF. So there we go. I can't remember if anybody ever saw him. I know I want to say that Inoki, so a frequent thing they used to do with the Japanese guys, and the reason that Inoki made the deal with Vince Senior was because Giant Barber in All Japan, his great rival, had allied himself with the NWA. So it was Barber who got to book the NWA champion. If Ric Flair went over to Japan, he would have been facing All Japan guys, not New Japan guys. Okay. And there are some tremendous Ric Flair matches in Japan. He faces Jumbo Tsuruta. Hardy Race has got some good matches over there as well. So anyway, the NWA champions would face Barber's crew, not Inoki's crew. And it was a frequently done thing when they'd go over to Japan. In Japan they work tours. They don't work a kind of regular schedule. They always work tours. And the NWA champ would rock up, and you'd be there for a month or whatever, and maybe he'd drop the belt in the first few nights on the tour, and the Japanese guy would become the champion, and that would get over not only the legitimacy of the belt in Japan, but also it would put the guy over in Japan, massively, and then by the end of the tour, they drop the belt back. So they could say, "Well, I have been the world champion," and then when the belt would arrive back, if they mentioned it, if they say, "Oh, well, Antonio Inoki has become the world champion," it got over in the idea in the minds of the fans the idea that wrestling was a big deal around the world. This is truly a world belt. Somebody in Japan can win it. It's in Japan. It's miles away. I mean, they'd never see them. They never. So that was the idea of these kind of deals to try to. Tried to really build up the prestige of the belt, and because Vince Senior wanted his belt to be a kind of rival world belt, and Inoki was trying to gain some of that prestige that Barber was getting with his NWA connection for himself, I want to say, you'd have to check the record books, but I think Inoki won the belt from Backlund in 79, and then Backlund dropped it back to Backlund before he came back. Yeah, you'd have to double check that, but so anyway, this that was that. Okay, so another one of the backroom staff was Arnold Scarland, another kind of a card playing, cigar smoking character, and he was actually a former wrestler, still got into the ring on occasion. I think in the early 70s, he may have had a few matches. By the time that, he's really old by the time he got to the late 70s and the 80s. famously, you probably know that he was the guy who threw in the towel for Backlund against when the Iron Sheik was breaking Backlund's back and making him humble, getting him in the camel clutch. It was Scarland who threw in the towel. But anyway, Scarland in real life, not just on screen, acted as the handler and the manager of the champion, booked their venues ahead of time, made sure they arrived in places. And there was a very specific code for how the champion was meant to act. And Bruno Sammartino, like, he would always be suited and booted wherever he went, always act a complete gentleman, you know, shaking people's hands. And he was like a real ambassador for the brand. I think the WWE continued that. I mean, you could see it in John Cena in a way. I mean, I know John Cena had that ridiculous spinny belt. I don't know if they still got that stupid thing, but, you know, John Cena, when he was in public, was always suited. You know, he was always smart. He was always polite. He was kind of a, like, an everyday American hero, you know? And, that was what Arnold Scarland was there for, was to make sure all of that sort of stuff went well. You know, Bruno's going to be interviewed by this magazine. He's going to, you know, he has to go and have dinner with Frank Sinatra. You know, Scarland handled all of that. And of course, all of these things, you know, you imagine you're a fan of the wrestling and, you know, they want you to think it's legit and real and so on. And, you know, you read in the paper, oh, you know, Bruno Sammartino was out with Frank Sinatra. That's a big deal. You know, he must be a major star, you know, all of this sort of stuff. And then he also ran the shows in White Plains in New York, just kind of a little local venue. For whatever reason, he was the handler there. So that's a kind of quick overview of the Vince Sr. crew. And now I'm going to get onto you with onto the actual formula. This is the Vince McMahon formula explained. Now while I'm this is the first time I'm looking at the chat. Just press one if you're enjoying this, and press two if you never want me to hear me talk about wrestling ever again. I can see some of my old buddies in the chat. He knows who he is. Some of my old wrestling buddies have cropped up. I'm pleased to see them. I hope you're doing fine. I hope the kids are doing fine, mate. You know, I'm not going to name him, but he knows who he is. I've just seen him there. Okay, people are enjoying it. Okay, so I'll carry on. This is not my return to the World of Wrestling podcasting, by the way. It's just a kind of, I was at a bit of a loose end what to do today, and I thought I'd knock this up. All right, so anyway, here is the Vince Sr. formula explained, okay? So the first thing to realize about this territory is that they had three managers who were known as the three wise men. The Grand Wizard, this guy on the left here, Lou Albano in the middle, and Freddie Blassie on the right. Okay. Fred Blassie was a absolutely legendary wrestler in his own right, massive star in the 50s, former world champ, you know, worked LA mainly. He was kind of a, you know, the Hollywood fashion plate. You know, he was a California guy. Lou Albano, some of you may know him from playing Mario in the mid 80s or from hanging out with Cyndi Lauper in the rock and wrestling era. But he was a kind of lower tier tag wrestler in his day, but really he was born to be a manager. So that was Lou Albano. And then the Grand Wizard, his real name was Ernie Roth, and he made his name in Detroit working with the Sheik. He was the Sheik's manager. He had a different name there. What was his name? Like Ed Farouk or something. I think he had a different name in Detroit. He didn't go by the Grand Wizard, but when he worked in New York, he became the Grand Wizard. He's very flamboyant, and I think the real Ernie Roth was gay, so he was kind of a bit of a Quentin Crisp character. And he, you know, very much looks after his wrestlers. Hangs up their cloak for them and all this sort of stuff. If you ever see him, you know, with Ken Patera, like, he treats Ken Patera like an Adonis, basically. So Grand Wizard's a bit of a weasel. Now, they had distinct roles, I would say, in the promotion. So the Grand Wizard often called himself the manager of champions, and he would tend to manage the main contenders, you know, the main challengers to Bruno or to Backlund. Typically, if they were going to have a major run, they'd stick them with the Grand Wizard. So the Grand Wizard was, I want to say he was the number one manager, but he tended to manage the serious contenders. Okay. I mean, more technical guys like Ken Patera, when he came in, was put with the Wizard. Greg Valentine, when he came in, was put with the Wizard, and so on and so forth. Freddie Blassie, he would tend to manage a lot of the big monsters and the foreign threats and kind of, I mean, I'd have to double check to see who exactly it was, but I'd imagine Blassie would manage like George the Animal Steel, Nikolai Volkov when he come in, or any of the Russians would be put with Blassie. So Blassie had a lot of the foreigners. And then Lou Albano, he was a tag team specialist. He would have a lot of the tag team champions. And I think his claim to fame was it 16 tag team champions he had? And Lou Albano was crazy promo. He managed one of my favorite teams of this era, Mr. Fuji and Mr. Saito, the Japanese team. And there's one promo where he puts on the Japanese garb, and he's talking absolute gibberish, trying to make out that he's speaking Japanese, but in fact, he's just talking gobbledygook. It's a fantastic promo if you can find that one. So Lou Albano is a bit more of a kind of comedy act, but he was pretty over in his own right. And unlike Wizard, Lou Albano could take bumps. So you'd often see Lou Albano crop up in the special attraction match, sometimes in handicap matches, because, you know, the fans would want to see him get his comeuppance. So, and Blassie, as a former manager, could also take bumps on occasion, although I can't actually remember seeing Blassie take any bumps ever. But Albano would have get in the ring, often he'd be like kind of chased around and chased out of the arena, and you know, fans would be laughing, falling over themselves laughing to see Captain Lou get his comeuppance. So they had like slightly different utilities on the card, but regardless of who it was that was being the Rock, Don Morocco there, later managed by Mr. Fuji, of course, but here he is with a Grand Wizard. And so what would happen is that a new heel would come in, and they'd be coming into the arena, and they'd be managed by one of the three wise men who would then transfer their heat to the new guy to get them over with the crowd. Okay, so the Grand Wizard was hated. You know, they were used to hating him. They know to hate him. So you stick Don Morocco, who nobody knows, and you stick him with the Grand Wizard. Instantly, now Don Morocco is over with the crowd. They know to boo him. Okay. Now the fact that the heel will be going up against the beloved Bruno in and of itself would generate heat, but pairing them with a hated manager will also give them what they call a rub. You know, it's just like it's just a constant conveyor belt of heat generation. You know, so they were like the three wise men with the linchpins of the division. Now, before I get on to, I'll just very quickly say the structure, I have always said, is very similar to 1960s Adam West Batman, wherein, there's a villain of the month, and then for the hero, overcomes that villain, but then before they know it, the next villain of the month is in. You know, Batman has defeated the Riddler, but now Catwoman's in, and now he defeats Catwoman, and now it's the Bookworm or whatever, and it's very much like that. You know, as soon as Don Morocco is dealt with, here's Greg Valentine. As soon as Greg Valentine, Swede Hansen is back, or whatever it happens to be. Okay, so there's a constant conveyor belt of villains coming in week after week, month after month. And then there was a set formula for how a heel would work a loop. Okay, so here's Stan Hansen. Remember I said Blassie would have the foreign threats and the big monsters? Well, Stan the Lariat Hansen was a big monster in 1976. Incidentally, a massive star in his own right. In fact, hold on. Before we get to the loop, I wanted to say on this structure of the managers, this is another of the things that Vince Jr. keeps going when he takes over promoting in 1983. If you really think about it, Jimmy Hart, the Mouth of the South, when he comes in, more or less takes over the role of Lou Albano. You know, you can remember Jimmy Hart getting chased out of the arena many times, manager of many tag teams. So the Captain Lou role was taken over by Jimmy Hart. Blassie, I think formally, did he sell his entire roster of stars to Reverend Slick at one point? I can't. What did he sell it? Anyway, Blassie is his kind of stable of stars, I think, is taken over by Mr. Fuji and Slick. I think they divide up Blassie stars between them two. And, of course, the Grand Wizard, his role is taken over by Bobby the Brain Heenan. So Bobby the Brain is in the Grand Wizard role. Jimmy Hart is in the Lou Albano role. And the Blassie role is kind of shared between Mr. Fuji and Slick. So, and they keep that structure going, that kind of constant conveyor belt. And once you spot this loop, you'll notice how Vince Jr. kept this loop going, at least in the initial run of Hogan, up until about 87, I would say. They kept this basic structure even against Hogan. You know, Kamala would come in, or you know, one of the Wild Samoans would come in, or whoever it happened to be. You know, King Kong Bundy this week, or you know, Paul Orndorff next week. So this is Stan the Lariat Hansen, great star in Japan, one of the all-time. I mean, if I had to rank all of my best wrestlers, which I did once, Stan Hansen's easily in the top three. Was he in the top three? Top five, maybe. I mean, I don't know. Stan Hansen's surely up there. And if you've never seen any Japanese wrestling or any footage of Andre the Giant outside of you know the famous stuff in WWF, I would encourage you to seek out a match between Stan Hansen and Andre the Giant from 1981. If that floats your boat, you know, let me know. Anyway, the set formula was the heel would come in, they debut on TV, and they'd have wins on Championship Wrestling or on All Star against jobbers, and then in the middle of the TV show, they would have time with you know, Vince Smarmy, young Vince, and their manager. They'd have an interview in front of the ring like this, where they'd be saying, you know, I can only imagine that Stan Hansen was a bit like Bruno Sammartino, I'm coming for you. I've arrived in New York and I'm ready to win the belt type thing. You know, typical promo from Blassie, now the phenomenal talker, a lot of charisma. You know, they come in, they debut, they get these wins against, you know, Frankie Williams and Johnny Rods or whoever else. And then they'd have a match at MSG. One thing I should say here is that not everybody does this full seven, you know, they don't do this full seven stage loop every time. This is the maximum that heel coming in could do. If they sticked around for like 5-6 months, they do this entire thing. But many guys would skip one or two or even four, you know. It's possible for somebody to come in and only do like two of these stages. But this is the maximum that they could do. So they'd come in, they'd have the win against the jobbers. Then they'd go in and have a match at MSG to introduce them to the crowd. They'd get a win over Dominic DiNucci, Ivan Putski, or Chief J Strongbow, possibly injuring the babyface. Famously, Greg Valentine broke J Strongbow's leg. Valentine also broke Wahoo McDaniel's leg. I don't know if Greg Valentine had a thing against Native American wrestlers or what, but anyway, I loved it every time Valentine broke Strongbow. I really hate Chief J Strongbow, but anyway, yeah. So you know, they do something villainous to get them over, and I mean, you probably remember if you're familiar with the kind of later era, you can still see Vince Jr. doing this to an extent. A match I can point to would be Yokozuna versus Virgil at SummerSlam 92, where they debut Yokozuna and he basically just squashes Virgil. You know, the beloved Virgil destroyed by Yokozuna, causing an injury, instantly getting over this as the next big threat. You know, within a couple of weeks, Yokozuna's in the world title picture, right? And eventually winning it at SummerSlam, at WrestleMania 9, you know, a few months later, right? So this is a kind of well-known trope. You know, you have to have a big win against a fairly well-known face to get yourself over. Then they'd have their first match against the champ, and it would be, you know, let's say it was Stan Hansen versus Bruno. You know, it would be a cheap result, a draw. Vince Sr. loved the blood stoppage draw, you know, where it's, the referee has had to stop the match due to blood. Or it would be a cheap win, you know. Maybe Hansen gets fed up and gets his bull rope out and tries to start like whipping Bruno or whatever, or as a count out or whatever. But it's basically a way for nobody to lose. So you'd never see Bruno pinned. Bruno was never pinned apart from by Ivan Koloff that one time. It was more to keep this feud going, to keep the heat of the heel live without seeing Bruno pinned. So that was the design. So setting up a rematch next month, of course, where they do it again. You know, you'd get another cheap finish. Again, if the first one was a draw, the second one would be a cheap win. If the first one was a cheap win, the second one would be a draw. And then finally in the third time, you know, the second rematch, they'd have the blow off versus the champ. Usually a gimmick match. It could be a cage match. It could be some sort of strap match. It could be a Texas death match. But there'd be some sort of stipulation where, you know, cheating couldn't be involved, or, you know, Bruno's finally pissed enough that he's ready to just lose it. And, usually what would happen is that Bruno would just kind of come out of the gates. He'd lose his temper and he'd eat them alive and the crowd would go nuts. You know, he'd win in about 6-7 minutes. But, and that was the loop basically. So, you know, you're building up heat for these first four matches, and then they get the massive blow off, send the crowd home happy, seeing Bruno get his arm raised yet again. And I'll just say that the way these matches were worked is that Bruno was not, how can I say, it's like Hulk Hogan would get his ass kicked for most of the match and he'd generate sympathy in that way, and then he'd make a big comeback. Bruno was also very good at generating sympathy in that way, but he'd never really get his ass kicked. Like, he worked strong. Backlund did as well. They both worked very strong. It was difficult to get, like, they never looked, even when they were taking a pounding, it was never for that long, really. So it was usually something cheap that would get the heel, like, dominating Bruno. And he was very good at generating sympathy when he had to. But then, when it was time for him to win, he won big. He won strong. He won clean. No questions asked. And then, if it was time for the heel to go, you wouldn't see him again. That would be it. if he stuck around, let's say, I don't know, he signed like a 6 months contract or something, then on his way out, he'd put over some of the regular faces. You know, he'd return the, let's say he beat Putski coming in, he'd take a loss to Putski going out, or Strongbow, or maybe this is a good time to bring in Andre. You know, we've already established this guy. You've seen him lose to Bruno. Now let's see what he does against Andre. Maybe a tag match, something like this, and then they'd leave the territory. And that is the go-round, okay? Now, the same heel, this is Greg Valentine, by the way. Again, if you remember Greg Valentine, you know, in his older days, you'd think, oh, he was a bit boring or a bit of a kind of like average wrestler or whatever. But he wasn't. I mean, Greg Valentine was a phenomenal talent. Great, stiff, you know, really, really good worker in the early 80s and in the late 70s as well. One of his best runs is when he comes in against Backlund, and then he has a some great IC title feuds as well after that. But anyway, Greg Valentine is a good example of what I'm talking about in a second. I'll tell you about it. So the same heel could work consecutive loops in MSG, Philly, Spectrum, and the Boston Garden. So in theory, they could get 9 shots at the champion if they worked all 3 loops. Okay, so in theory, somebody could come in. Let's say Stan Hansen, he'd have 3 matches at MSG, 3 matches in the Philly Spectrum, and 3 matches in Boston. However, in practice, this rarely happened because they'd often work different, like the champ, Bruno, would work different opponents in different cities. So let's see, he was working like Stan Hansen and MSG. I mean, we could even double check. So let me just pull up results for 1976. And we'll see. Let's have a look. WWE results for 1976. It'd be good to see, like, what was the loop in 1976? Like, who was Bruno facing in each of the venues that year? So MSG in January. Superstar Graham wins. Oh, maybe 76 is not a good example, but Graham versus Bruno in MSG, then in Boston, in the Boston Garden. Yeah, you see, you put the tag champs on top there. It was just Superstar Graham versus Bruno again in Boston Gardens. Okay, so they're working both Boston and MSG. San Martino versus Graham in Pittsburgh Civic Arena. Okay, so they really did work Graham versus San Martino everywhere. San Martino versus Graham at Madison Square Garden in February. Okay, so they did do it. Let's have a look. Where's the next Spectrum? Philly Spectrum, San Martino versus Ivan Koloff. Okay, so all right, but they've switched it up now. So the next MSG match is San Martino versus Ernie Ladd. So he's working Ernie Ladd in MSG. He's working Ivan Koloff in Philly. And then I think that keeps on going, doesn't it? So let's have a look at the next month, for example. Next MSG match, Ivan Koloff again in a tag match against Bruno. And next Philly match, Ivan Koloff again. So they just brought in Ernie Ladd for that one date. So you can see it doesn't always work. You know, it's not always that everybody does all of the dates. They'd mix and match it as well. Heels would sometimes work a truncated loop, sometimes just a one shot. Often in the schedule, there'd be like a month where nothing was going on. And it'd be like Bruno Sammartino versus Bulldog Brower or Swede Hansen or some of the, you know, they bring in some of these sorts of guys to just to plug a hole. Peter Maivia was a one shot, I think. Sometimes they'd work a two shot where it's just like, you know, two undone, sometimes a full three. And you can typically judge how well a heels run went by how many loops and how many dates within each loop they worked. And the reason I picture Greg Valentine here is because when he came in against Backlund in 81, I think they worked like a huge amount of dates that year. And he did like, he did a lot of the, he completed a lot of dates around, you know, they worked in Philly, they worked in MSG, they worked in Boston. So obviously Greg Valentine in 81 had a very good run. And I think another example was it Pat Patterson or Buddy Rose? I think it was it Pat Patterson against Backlund? Could have been Buddy Rose, but there was another guy who came in who actually worked four consecutive MSG dates against Backlund. So that's usually a sign that something has gone right. Okay. So yes. And here's a kind of typical structure. We used this Stan Hansen against Sammartino. This was the famous card in which Sammartino had his neck broken by Hansen, went in a bit stiff with the lariat. You can see Andre the Giant versus Ernie Ladd on the as the semi-main. Haystacks Calhoun and Pat Barrett versus Superstar Graham and Koloff. That's a pretty big match to have on the card as well. And then you can see some of the, you know, Ric Flair versus Frankie Williams, Tony Parisi versus Baron Cicluna, Dominic DiNucci versus Lewis Carr, and Bobo Brazil was on the card. So you can see attendance was 17,000, pretty good gate. Vince on the commentary. And then we can look, they had this opener match, kind of nothing match. Tony Parisi versus Baron Cicluna, Johnny Rods versus Louis Cook. I mean, you can imagine these are slow. Nobody really cares about these matches. But if you can imagine, people are arriving at their seats, they're buying popcorn, they're going to get beer, they're talking to their friends, they're, you know, just getting comfortable. And this is what these matches are there for. Look, Ric Flair comes to town. I mean, Ric Flair in 76 was not, you know, the Ric Flair at that point. But this would have been a nice experience for him to go up to New York at that time. I don't know if he ever talks about it. But look, he's facing the absolute jobber's jobber, Frankie Williams, there. Just a kind of little, you know, little date for Flair there. And then there's the main event, Stan Hansen versus Bruno. Bobo Brazil is the US champion, comes in against Rocky Tour. Now, I'm not sure what Bobo Brazil was doing there. I want to say that Bobo Brazil probably would have been coming in, working an outside, like he was probably working for the Sheik or someone like that. Don't know what US belt that is there. Is that the Detroit US belt? Somebody would have to check what Bobo Brazil was doing in town. But I'll explain more about what I think that match is about in a second. Then you see like Dominic DiNucci versus this dude. And then, you know, big tag match and Andre versus Ladd. So if we were to break down what this card is, we've got, you know, Jobber to the Stars, Homesteader. So that's just, you know, this Louis Cardin, just one of these Italian dudes that had been there forever, taking on Baron Cicluna, another jobber to the stars. So just to explain, a jobber is somebody who just always loses, like Frankie Williams, a pure jobber. Jobber to the stars is a rung up from that. It's somebody who's an established star. He's got name recognition. Maybe they faded a bit, like Baron Cicluna is a good example. He used to be a main eventer, but he's been hanging around on the undercard forever now. So it means a bit more to beat Baron Cicluna than it does to beat Frankie Williams, because at least there's a theoretical chance that Cicluna could win, right? How often Cicluna actually did win, I'm not sure. Like, but Cicluna might get the odd win on TV. So, you know, on the typical episode of Championship Wrestling, it could be Baron Cicluna versus Frankie Williams. Well, Cicluna would beat Frankie Williams. So that's a jobber to the stars. They, you know, they beat jobbers, but they lose to stars. So that there's two of those in a row, which is, I mean, if you watch some of these cards, it's kind of it's brutal, slow, plodding, I mean, I kind of built up an appreciation for it, but you know, if you're used to a different product, it's can be a little bit difficult to get into at first. And then, you know, then we had the Flair match, just a star versus the jobber, kind of a fledgling star at that point. Even if he'd have got over in Mid-Atlantic at that point, Flair would have been unknown in New York, so they were just trying to establish him, I guess. Not quite sure what he was doing there, actually. Don't know the story of Flair in New York in 76, but anyway, then we have the main event, and this is something else that you will notice, that the main event did not always go on last. And that is because there were, I want to say there was some old like curfew rule, or people needed to get home because they were in New York, right? You know, they needed to take the subway or whatever it was. So they put the main event there so that everybody would catch the main event. And there was a big kind of break after that. And if you have a look at the early Vince Jr. cards, they do that with Hogan as well. The Hogan match is often on in the middle of the card, not at the end of the card. So that's kind of a long-standing thing. Then you get a featured exhibition match where you either get some outside talent coming in, maybe get the ladies match, you know, the Fabulous Moolah and her girls, you know, maybe she'll put on a match, or the Midgets, or maybe the Lucha, you know, you get a Luchador match. Who's that famous guy? You know, not Dos Caras, you know, the famous Luchador. Maybe my buddy's still in the chat. He'll tell me who it is. Is he still there? Who's the very famous Luchador? Yeah, that's it. Mil Máscaras. That's it. You know, Mil Máscaras might come to town and they'll put on an exhibition match. And it's kind of, or occasionally it'd be like, oh, the NWA champion is here. It's a Harley Race versus this guy. So every once in a while they put on a spot match for, you know, to help somebody else out like that. Something a bit different, so it's not always the same. You know, ladies, midgets. And I think, I could be wrong, but I think that Bobo Brazil match was that. Some kind of weird talent exchange he'd done with a Sheik or something. And, you know, maybe what it was, right? I'm just guessing now. But if I was to guess, I'd say Vince Sr. had done a deal with a Sheik. You bring in Bobo Brazil to work MSG one time. In exchange, I'll work, you know, Bruno comes and faces me, you know, for a payday in Detroit, something like that. And, I mean, I think Bruno versus the Sheik was a fairly regular feud in Detroit, because Bruno would also work outside sometimes. I mentioned he went to St. Louis a couple of times, but I mean, he would work for the Tunnies in Toronto fairly regularly, and he'd also work dates with the Sheik as well. So maybe that's what Bobo Brazil was doing there. And this is part of the thriller, but you know, when you're really into wrestling, you'd be like, it's a bit weird, why is Bobo Brazil there? And I'd like, once upon a time I would have lost an hour like trying to find out why is Bobo Brazil in on this card. Also, I mean, I'm also wondering now, like, why is Ric Flair there in 76? Who knows what he was doing? We have what I call a cooler match. Now, do you remember what I was saying about Vince Sr. telling guys off for working too hard? Like, there's a famous jobbery guy called Larry Sharp who tells a story about this. He says, like, you know, works his socks off, tries to put on the best match possible, goes and gets a bollocking from Vince Sr. And the reason is, there were matches like this, what I've called a cooler match. Now, you imagine you're in that crowd now, okay? You spend the first two matches kind of finding a seat, you know, going to the toilet, buying your popcorn, you know, throwing nuts at the person, you know, a couple of rows down, picking your nose, whatever else. You finally get your seat. You're like, you know, just settling down. As you're settling down, you're watching this young guy face a jobber. Then there's the moment you've come from. you see, you know, you're in the absolute shock of seeing Bruno get his neck broken on this particular occasion, but massive match against Stan Hansen. You don't want to get these fans too burnt out, so you put on a match like this cooler match. What was the cooler match? Dominic DiNucci versus Louis. Like, I can only imagine how dire that match is, right? It'd be slow, it'd be plodding, fans would be half asleep, etc. But there's a reason for that, is because if you put this Andre match directly after the Bruno match, the fans would be burnt out. They need time to relax, to catch their breath. And that's something else that you see, you know, again, it's different booking philosophies, but over on Crockett, they'd often load the card. They'd be like, right, we're going to give a big semi-main, and then we're going to hit them straight away with the main event. And I think in the Vince Sr. school of thinking, like, you're overloaded, you're working too hard there, but you're also not managing the energy of the crowd. And this is something else that I think Vince Jr. did quite well, at least up until the mid-90s. You know, you'll often see, be like, oh, what's this Ted DiBiase, you know, random match doing on this card? Or what's this nothing match here, like Hercules or Hernandez versus whoever it happens to be? And often it's that. It's just a kind of cooler match. You know, a match for the crowd to catch their breath while, you know, they're getting over some massive dramatic event they've just seen and gearing up for some, you know, the next big thing. And that's what this match would have been doing on this card. And then, of course, the crowd would have gone absolutely wild to see Andre the Giant. You know, he wasn't there every week. Maybe they only see him once a year or twice a year. So it was a big deal for Andre to come in. Or sometimes they'd put a handicap match in there. Do you remember I mentioned Lou Albano again in the ring? Like, this is the sort of slot that you'd see a Lou Albano in. Something just to get the crowd excited before they go home. Tag title match, whatever it happens to be. You get the kind of special attraction. Later on down the line, of course, the IC belt comes in, and you'd often see the IC title match, you know, slotted in around here as well. All right, and that's it. That is the Vince McMahon Senior booking philosophy and formula. I've talked for just over 2 hours. Let's see if anybody has any questions or comments. So I'll just have a quick look at the old super chats here, if there were any. Let's have a look. Okay, that's all right. So there has been a few super chats. Let me deal with these, and then we'll get out of here. I also forgot to put the entropy on today. Sorry, I keep on forgetting about the entropy. Sorry about that, folks. It's just a new, you know, it's just another thing, and sometimes I'm in a bit of a rush and I forget to put it on. So let's have a look at the super chats. I've just turned the entropy on now. If anybody's still interested, I know some people don't like to give YouTube money. Okay, so Jacaranda Plus says, Jacaranda, I think Morkar would be interested in the game Disco Elysium. Also go on EFAP. You don't have to stay for the whole 12 hours. I'm still dubious about that. Okay, Disco Elysium. I'll check that out. The English Loyalist says, dude, I have been waiting for knowledge on the wrestling world. I would love to hear about the business. Please do WCW. I can't wait to hear about that, especially the supposed terrible Kevin Nash booking. Yeah, I mean, saying do WCW is quite, you know, you'd have to pick a kind of era, really. WCW has distinct phases. The era when Kevin Nash was booking was pretty late on, to be honest. But I might have a look. I mean, if we're doing booking philosophies, I might do a show on Dusty Rhodes' booking style. He has a very distinct booking philosophy. A lot of overbooking, a lot of, you know, screw job finishes. In contrast to Vince Sr., Dusty Rhodes like to have a babyface chasing the heel champion. Yeah, a lot of gimmick matches. Dusty would overload cards, to be honest. So in many ways, the Dusty booking style was the complete opposite of the Vince Senior one. Coney said, "Are you using your Blue Yeti microphone?" I am indeed, Coney. This is the first show I'm doing without mic. Although the one about libertarianism earlier on was also on this mic as well. Hopefully it's good. Time Stealer says Nescafe Gold equals stream latte. Nana Taulas equals stream on time. Coincidence? I think not. Well, if you notice, I always stream on time when it's a solo stream. It's usually I'm waiting for a guest for some reason, or we're trying to get something right. Owine says, if you ever want a tag partner on this AA, I'm here plodding about in the mid-card like a Hacksaw Jim Duggan. Well, the thing is, Owine, Hacksaw Jim Duggan was a major star before he arrived in the WWF. I mentioned Ted DiBiase. The feud that Hacksaw Jim Duggan has with DiBiase in Mid-South is really needs to be seen. People talk about their tuxedo. Was that the multi-gimmick tuxedo match that he has? But all of the run-up to that is some phenomenal wrestling television. So a lot of the guys that you know would have had, like, the whole reason they arrive in the WWF is because they were a major talent in some way. So Jim Duggan's a good example. Like, you think, oh, well, this is just a kind of mid-card, nothing guy. But actually, he had a great career before he arrived in the WWF. Oh, Ian says, rest holds and some more rest holds. Well, you see, this is what I was trying to explain to you, though, is that this internet kind of smart way of seeing wrestling is like, oh, any hold is a rest hold now. What? So you want your guys always to be jumping around and doing 15 suplexes? You know, this sort of thing needs to be trained out if you want a true appreciation of what wrestling is all about. There is such a thing as a rest hold, and you're probably going to see one or two of them in the typical Dominic DiNucci match, but still, there is a way of there is an appreciation of working smart. You know, someone like Jerry Lawler would be a good example. Like, someone who does very few moves, nothing more complex than a punch a lot of the time, and yet got the crowd eating out the palm of his hand. That makes Jerry Lawler twice the worker of your typical kind of, you know, go, 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 1,000 miles an hour work rate indie wrestler. Yeah, the idea that a rest hold is always bad, for example. That said, I am not sitting through Backman versus Inoki again. No way. Chu Chillen says, yesterday on Unpopular Opinions, the scientism narrative switch was discussed. The most laughable I have seen was dark matter. This was created to solve maths problems and recently was just completely thrown out as not real. Lol. Is that true? Dark matter's not real, is it? I'd have to look into that, but that's interesting. Akronite 87 says, Hisashi Shinma was the Japanese president. They even made Tokyo their kayfabe HQ for a while. Yes, thanks a lot for that. I was stumbling around looking for that name. Hisashi Shinma. They really worked quite hard to get over that New York... New Japan connection, and it lasted for years. You know, there's a really good Tokyo card from 1990, but it's also surreal because it's like peak 1990 WWF guys and like peak 1990 New Japan guys all on the same loaded card. But it's kind of a strange, like, I always remember like Sherry Martel and kind of doing her usual Superstars of Wrestling shtick in front of a kind of New Japan 1990 crowd sitting on their hands. So it's kind of a weird culture clash. some of those cards, but they're a lot of fun. And in fact, I would say if you ever want to get into Japanese wrestling, it's a pretty nice way in to approach it by watching cards of American wrestlers you already know, right? Guys you already know from a different context inserted into that. That's why I mentioned that 1981 Andre the Giant versus Stan Hansen match. I mean, not only is a great match, but it's like you can kind of get Japanese wrestling more when you see some of your own guys in there as well, or guys that you're used to. I mean, if you search long enough, you'll find hours of me talking about Japanese wrestling somewhere on the internet. But I'm not going to tell you where. Akron 87 says, Hogan was initially a weird babyface because he would punch people, which was illegal at the time. He'd even spit on opponents. Yeah, that's true. I mean, Hogan was kind of almost like worked like a rule breaker sometimes because he got so angry. And some of these subtleties are lost on certain modern audiences. I'd also say that there's a kind of an interesting kind of punkish energy and violence to early Hogan, like Hogan in 84, 85, even 86 Hogan. Some of those matches are really bloody, you know, like they're kind of interesting, visceral energy. I wasn't trying to knock Hogan earlier when I was saying that about his inability to draw month on month. It's just kind of a recognizing a reality of the sort of star he was. Also, I would say, you know, I was saying about the electric white heat that Bruno Sammartino had. If you ever get a chance to see Hogan in the AWA before he left, you know, when he was going up against Bockwinkle and so on in 82, he had electric heat, you know, and also early Hogan in WF had huge heat, electric heat. So, I don't want to take anything away from Hogan. He was a phenomenal worker in his own right. And again, someone who never did anything much more complex than the punching and kicking, really. But, you know, Hogan was a great worker. Much better than some of these flippy doodahs. Matt C says, hey, AA, I noticed you're always commenting on Mr. D's choice of fonts. How about a deepest lore on typography? Thanks for everything. Well, I know nothing about typography, but Mr. D knows a lot about typography, so I could suggest it to him. I think he might enjoy going in depth about typography. It could be like a kind of ASMR stream where Mr. D talks about typography. All right, so I think that's it for the wrestling. For the wrestling stuff. Hope people enjoyed this. I try to educate people, and I'll see you tomorrow night for Cigar Stream, where Yiz will be coming on, and we're going to be talking, and Panama Hat is going to be coming back, because people took exception to what we were saying about nationalism and patriotism and so on, and we're going to talk about nationalism and patriotism and whether it has a place, so etc. And we'll talk about that tomorrow. Hold on, before we go, some super Yiz has come in with some super chats on Entropy. Yiz says, "Deepest Lore is the most enjoyable solo stream on the internet. Would you be interested in a Deepest Lore about Hollywood movie studios or any particular slice of it?" Yiz the Eunuch also says, "Dark matter was never claimed to be real. It was a spaceholder term for the mystery mass they couldn't sort out. Like black holes, they give something confounding a name, so it's easy to talk about." Yeah, I mean, one of the things I was thinking about talking about today was the Wu-Tang Clan. And Jizza Genius has been talking about bringing out an album called Dark Matter for years now, and it never comes out. Never ever comes out so there we go. And thanks for saying Deepest Lore. I think it's grown its own little fandom. I mean, Hollywood movie studios could be interesting. It's a topic we'd have to kind of hash out and think about you know, exactly, you know, because it's a big topic, but yeah, it could be something to think about. Many angles, of course, when it comes to thinking about Hollywood and its history. All right. Thank you very much, everyone. Now get out. Yeah, indeed. Protect your neck from Stan Hansen.